Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. So many departures from orthodoxy today. We'll hear from Ariel Klagsbrunn, who's been fighting the underexposed right-wing billionaire Jeff Yass, and then a debate between Sara Bomari of Compact Magazine and labor journalist Hamilton Nolan about the allegedly pro-worker Republicans like J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley. First, Jeff Yass. I spent a lot of time studying money bags and their engagement with politics, but until recently I hadn't paid much attention to Jeff Yass. Yass, based in the Philadelphia suburbs, is a major funder of right-wing politicians and organizations in that state and around the country. Here to brief us is Ariel Klagsbrunn, the deputy campaign director for ACRE, the Action Center on Race and the Economy, who works with its All Eyes on Yass campaign. Ariel Klagsbrunn. The authorities disagree on the dimensions of his cash pile. Bloomberg says $45.6 billion. Forbes, just a mere $28.5 billion, but obviously the guy has a pile of it. Where did his money come from?
Jeff Yass is the founder and managing director of Susquehanna International Group, which is a billion-dollar market-making Wall Street firm that really is, in many ways, a sprawling web of many financial interests put together. What SIG does and other firms like that, like Citadel and others, they really play a role within Wall Street of being a middleman for the markets. So you may have been familiar with when the Robinhood scandal happened, for example, the role of Citadel was put into the limelight. SIG is very similar in that way. In particular, Jeff Yass's wealth has gone up in the past couple of years because they have direct investments in ByteDance, which is the Chinese firm that owns TikTok. And so as TikTok's market share has gone up and assessment of TikTok's value, so has Jeff Yass's. As you said, it fluctuates. Some days it's $30 billion, some days it's more. But SIG continues to be a huge Wall Street firm here in the U.S. and then obviously globally. And as what we've seen here in Pennsylvania is as Yass's wealth has gone up, so has his kind of political spending and political impact.
You say Wall Street, but they were originally in Philadelphia, and he moved to Ballast-Cynwood to avoid paying Philadelphia taxes. So he's one of these guys who just doesn't pay a dime in taxes if he can avoid it.
Absolutely, yes. Folks who know Jeff Yass have said he hates paying effing taxes. It's a huge part of their business model. In fact, ProPublica found that, you know, they would estimate that Yass and some of his associates have underpaid close to $1 billion in federal taxes. It actually seems like it's a core way in which the SIG business model is set up, that they can avoid paying taxes, certainly on a federal level. And yeah, he has sued both the federal government, the state of Pennsylvania multiple times to avoid paying taxes. It seems like a key part of both their business model and his personal beliefs.
And I also read that he really loves poker.
Yes, he actually got his start playing poker. That's like the story that they tell. And it's very woven into the business model of SIG as well. They recruit new employees through poker tournaments. I think it's a really indicative of how Jeff Yass thinks about the world, right? It's all kind of a game to him, and he is, you know, making these bets really to amass wealth. To Jeff Yass, it really is all just a poker tournament, but the real impact is that it's working people's lives, and he's actually gambling on our future here.
You mentioned TikTok, and he's a big investor in ByteDance. That must put him at odds with a lot of his friends on the right.
Jeff Yass's politics are, he would identify as a libertarian. What we've seen here is that certainly in Pennsylvania and what's happening nationally too, where it advances his political interests and his business interests, he's happy to swallow things on the right that he might not directly agree with, whether it's around abortion or social issues that he might have a more libertarian view on. He actively invests in candidates and gives to candidates who are spewing hate and, you know, seeding division in order to advance a ultra-right political agenda. And whether Jeff Yass believes in any of that stuff or not, those are the choices that he's making. in terms of investments for his political giving and political spending.
For these guys, it seems like all they really care about is tax cuts and deregulation and everything else, whatever, as long as I get my tax cuts.
Yep.
He's a heavy contributor to a lot of national right-wing causes, not just candidates, but also organizations. What are his political priorities?
Jeff Yass is, I think, the largest donor to the Club for Growth PAC, which is a PAC that also gets huge investment from Richard Uihlein in Wisconsin. I would say an ultra-right PAC, really focused on market deregulation, but has invested in, spent money on candidates like Ted Cruz, Lauren Boebert, Josh Hawley. You know, these are obviously people who support overturning democracy, strong ties to January 6th. They support QAnon conspiracies, right? Here in Pennsylvania and increasingly nationally, he's investing in a bunch of statewide infrastructure around school privatization. Here in PA, he has a network of PACs that he gives to political action committees that are really focused on taking public tax dollars for private and religious schools. With that, very anti-union, especially teachers unions. And we've seen the infrastructure that he's built in Pennsylvania really over a decade. He's now trying to recreate that in states like Texas, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas. In Texas, he just gave the largest political donation in Texas history around school privatization issues. His focus on schools in particular obscures, I think, what many of us believe to be true, right? The way that we actually win quality public schools for every kid in Pennsylvania and across the country is by putting lots of money into schools and having here in Pennsylvania, it's been ruled that our schools are unconstitutional. The funding levels are unconstitutional in terms of giving every child in the Commonwealth a quality public education. And so the real conversation we need to be having is about how we actually fully fund our schools by taxing billionaires, taxing the rich so that they're paying their fair share. And instead, what we've seen in PA is that every budget cycle for the past couple of years, we've had a fight about public tax dollars going into private schools instead. So I think a big part of our work here in PA is how do we make it clear that Jeff Yass's political agenda is not serving Pennsylvanian families. And actually what we need to be doing is taxing the rich and have a real conversation about how we fully fund our schools, public transit, all the issues that families really rely on.
This is a bit off topic, but how did the now passed over Josh Shapiro, where does he stand on school issues?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Josh Shapiro has been pro-school vouchers at various times. We ended up defeating the school voucher proposal that Jeff Yass and his PACs were really pushing in last year's budget and this year's budget. But Josh Shapiro has been vocal around supporting school vouchers, which is really, kind of shocking for a Democratic governor. And some of that comes from his ties to Jeff Yass. And I think today's news in particular around the VP choice, like, really makes it clear to me that there should not be room in the Democratic Party for, and really any political party, for people who are taking money from billionaires like Yass, who are actively destroying our democracy, and that's actually really politically unpopular.
I'm speaking with Arielle Klagsbrunn of the All Eyes on Yass campaign. And as I recall, at least several years ago, Philadelphia was pretty far along in charterizing the schools. Where's the city stand now?
Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia in many ways has been ground zero for school privatization dating back decades at this point. You know, there's a really big victory in about, 5 years ago, where Philadelphia regained local control of our schools and so are able to make decisions locally as opposed to a state-controlled school board, which really helped to advance some of the charter efforts. But I think it's always going to be an issue here. You know, we don't have charter accountability standards where charter schools are held to the same standards as public schools. And again, a lot of the kind of conversation about funding on the state level, we do have a program that Jeff Yass and many of his colleagues at Susquehanna have directly financially benefited from, which, you know, is a charter school incentive called the EITC, where charter school investors, which Yass has ties to some local charter schools, actually get money back from charters. So I think that's an issue that will continue to be at the forefront, really around like how we're winning. Just because you send your kid to a charter school doesn't mean they shouldn't be held to the same standards as public schools, because really every kid deserves the same quality public education.
Now, back to Yass, he's also pretty close to the Israeli right, isn't he?
Yeah, Yass and Arthur Danchik, who's another co-founder and now I think has retired at Susquehanna International Group, have ties to the Kohelet Policy Forum, which is a libertarian, right-wing Israeli lobbying firm, which has advocated for undermining the Israeli Supreme Court, was very active in the issue around Supreme Court democracy and judicial integrity in Israel, and then also pushes for the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Yeah, he's been very tied to that. He has a history of donating to the Claus Foundation, which has donated to the Friends of the IDF. And he's received a lot of pressure on this issue. Both him and Danchik have received pressure from groups including Israelis who were trying to stand for judicial integrity last year, to groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, who have actively called on Yass to disassociate himself from the Kohelet Policy Forum.
Given his role in financing the right, he doesn't seem to have as high a profile as he might. Is that deliberate? Is he a shy guy? He doesn't want to get his name in the papers?
Yeah, I would say for many years, part of Yass's influence was that it was in the background. We in Pennsylvania have obviously been tracking him for a long time because we've been ground zero for his political experiments. But I would say this year in particular, he has burst onto the scene, especially in the first half of the year. I think he was the top Republican funder or top political funder on the federal level, period. I think he's now in the top 10. It's been a big year of, and we've done a lot of work really to demand, you know, our campaign is named All Eyes on Yass, because we really think it's important to say publicly what's happening, who's actually driving it. You know, it's not just that we're having school board elections where we're debating banning books and if trans kids should have rights in school, right? It's actually being these kind of right-wing hate really is being funded by networks of billionaires who are trying to divide us in order to make political power grabs. So a big part of our work, we have a big coalition here in Pennsylvania that's done a lot of work to hold Yass accountable, highlight his role, and then say that no elected official should be taking money from Jeff Yass.
And what's his relationship with Trump?
Oh, yes. Very complicated, I would say. This is, again, an example where Yass's business interests trump all. So Yass had been kind of a never Trumper, certainly in 2016 to 2020. I think after the January 6th in particular, he did a lot of distancing from a bunch of the political actors that his PACs had supported. But this year he ended up meeting with Trump. They had a meeting at Mar-a-Lago. And during that meeting, something transpired between them. And afterwards, Trump, who, as we all might remember, had been very pro banning TikTok, changed his mind on that.
And he's very flexible if there's some money in it.
He's very flexible, yeah. He did a little flip-flop there. And, you know, Yass said, he wrote a long piece in the Wall Street Journal where he said he wouldn't be donating to Trump. Although I don't believe that he made any commitments around Club for Growth or other PACs not donating to Trump, but that he thought Trump would certainly be better than Biden. And so that's why he was engaging in this process and set of conversations with him. So, again, a really clear example about how you can swallow whatever qualms you might have with a candidate who's trying to destroy our democracy and breed hate and division and, you know, Islamophobia and anti-immigrant hate in order to advance your own bottom line.
And finally, how are you fighting Yass? What strategies are you using, and what might people elsewhere in the country are fighting similar local plutocrats? What might they learn from it?
Yeah, so I think a lot of our strategy, you know, we launched the All Eyes on Yass campaign a couple of years ago, and it's a large coalition of groups across Pennsylvania who've been really taking action to expose his growing role and raise awareness about Yass's political impact. We see Yass's agenda as really one that's about profiteering and privatizing. And so in particular, this year, we're part of a big push of community organizations and labor unions coming together to defeat school privatization efforts in the past two budget cycles and really stop YAS's agenda in its tracks. We've also used a tactic of we launched earlier this year the Healthy Democracy Pledge, which is asking all elected officials to refuse any contributions from YAS or his network of PACs where he's a majority donor, and also to resist his agenda. So we launched that. We've had dozens of elected officials sign that pledge actively. And, you know, I think that has really started to change the political tide here in PA. YAS for many years was a bipartisan donor. So he gave to Democrats and Republicans. And we've actually seen some movement, especially on the Democratic side, where we've gotten political candidates to return donations from YAS because they see it as politically toxic. And that has really been our strategy here. How do we toxify his money and make it clear to as many people as possible what this person is doing to impact our democracy? He's not the only one, right? This is about a system of billionaires and corporate interests that are trying to rig the rules. So ultimately, what we really need is to tax the rich so that billionaires and corporations pay what they owe. We need campaign finance limits so that we can curtail the influence of money in our politics. And we need lobbying reform laws, which is something that Pennsylvania doesn't really have.
That was Ariel Klagsbrunn, the Deputy Campaign Director for ACRE, the Action Center on Race and Economy, who works with their All Eyes on YAS campaign. Fun details about Jeff YAS and TikTok. As Ariel Klagsbrunn noted, when he was president, Donald Trump wanted to ban it. But he changed his mind after a meeting with YAS last March. Trump announced that change of mind in a characteristically vigorous fashion, saying Americans would go crazy without TikTok. He posted on his platform, Truth Social, "When you get rid of TikTok, Facebook and Zuckerschmuck will double their business. I don't want Facebook, who cheated in this last election, doing better. They are a true enemy of the people." Jeff YAS must be a pretty persuasive guy. Apparently so is the fellow he called Zuckerschmuck. Last week, Trump said that Zuckerberg, who called Trump's fist pump after his ear was grazed by a bullet badass, phoned him many times to make peace. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Money Talks, a 1977 song by the British punk band Penetration. A few weeks ago, I talked with Brandon Mencia of the United Auto Workers about allegedly pro-worker Republicans. He argued that it's all fake. I thought that it would be interesting to hear from a proponent of the position, Sohrab Omari, a founding editor of Compact Magazine and author most recently of Tyranny, Inc. But I wanted someone who covered labor to respond. Playing that role is journalist Hamilton Nolan, who has a Substack, How Things Work. His book, The Hammer, was published in February by Hachette. Sohrab Omari and Hamilton Nolan. Though the Walsh nomination seems to have prompted a bit of a rethink for you, you've been quite enthusiastic about the pro-worker rhetoric coming from J.D. Vance and other Republicans like Hawley. I have to say I'm skeptical that a party populated by heartland small business titans, private equity moguls, and a sprinkling of white supremacists, and a candidate whose political career is launched by Peter Thiel, can produce a pro-worker agenda. But maybe I'm wrong. So please make the case how the working class should welcome J.D. Vance.
I don't think I need to say this to you, gents, but we don't really have a Labor Party in the United States. We have two parties that are both coalitions of multiple class interests. So the Democrats, just to paint with a broad brush, represent important segments of Wall Street, Silicon Valley, really most of the professional class. And then they have the sort of legacy working class voters. They're hemorrhaging that over the past two election cycles, presidential election cycles, to the Republican Party and green tech and other types of industries as well. The Republican Party, I think you described it fairly well. It's a coalition of mainly extractive industries, a lot of domestic manufacturing, but not all of it. Then you have their wing of the Wall Street faction. You have, above all, absolutely right, you have the kind of small and regional capital, which is probably the most resistant to the kind of pro-worker reforms that I think everyone in this discussion wants to see. And then you have, yes, increasingly a kind of multiracial working class that is voting Republican. It began in 2016 with Donald Trump winning a decisive marginal share of union households in several of the kind of post-industrial battleground states. He extended that in 2020, making inroads among working class people of color. And if trends hold, he will continue to kind of make this realignment go forward. So with that being the backdrop, I don't think either party should be fetishized as the voice of the working class. They're both much more coalitional and complicated than that. I think what we want to see is a pro-worker agenda around higher union density, around revival of manufacturing, around stopping Wall Street's domination of the real economy, and things like that, healthcare, et cetera, emerge as a bipartisan center in the same way that the neoliberal order, the order inaugurated by, I would argue, Carter and Reagan, carried on by the Clintons and the Obamas, and likewise across the developed world, you know, it was neoliberalism was a quote-unquote bipartisan coalition of the likes of Thatcher, but also nominal labor politicians like Tony Blair and Gerhard Schröder in Germany, a social democrat. With that being the case, what we want to see is similarly a new consensus that is forged in the center of American politics. And so when individual politicians of both parties responding to what their own shifting vote patterns are telling them take up pro-worker agendas, that should just be encouraged. And that's my general stance. And it's why I wrote supportively of the Teamsters president, Sean O'Brien, appearing at the Republican National Convention, offering I think legitimate praise and well-deserved praise for Josh Hawley on a number of things where he's backed the Teamsters. He didn't go there and say, I now love the Republican Party. The Republican Party is great. He said, I just don't want to be beholden to either party. It is not healthy for the workers' movement in this country for it to be an adjunct of one of the two parties that is has some legacy of supporting workers, but is also, like the other party, beholden to capital as well. That's what we're working with here is people on the right and the left trying to forge a new consensus. And I'll end with this because I don't want to monopolize things. Donald Trump, with the campaign that he launched in 2016, I was a Wall Street Journal editorial writer at the time, and all of us on the establishment right were horrified when he began talking about tariffs, about rethinking neoliberal globalization. Fast forward 8 years, the Biden administration kept in place the Trump tariffs against China and actually extended industrial policy and did it in a more extensive way with the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act. That tells you something has changed. And I think American politics, the real shifts happen at the center between the two parties. And that's the kind of thing we should encourage. So all I ask pro-labor folks listening to me is not for them to become like Republicans. You won't, for all sorts of reasons. But to not have this tendency of being like, well, one side is just the only side who will support workers, and therefore I'm never going to forgive a labor leader, for example, like Sean O'Brien, for being open to working with individual Republicans, even as he's the lifelong Democrat. I'm pretty sure he's going to vote for Harris himself, but he represents a working class membership that, as he told me in an interview, and it was his first interview since giving that speech on the RNC floor, he said, I have people who are Democrats, I have people who are Republicans, and I have people who are independents. I have to try to represent all of them. I can't just represent those of my members who are Democrats.
Okay, Hamilton, that was a lot. Any response?
Yeah, that was a lot. I mean, we could probably stipulate that none of us in this conversation are neoliberals, so none of us will have to feel compelled to defend any of that. But I mean, I guess I would start by saying, like, when we talk about the Republican worker-friendly agenda, what is it? What does that mean exactly? What are the policies behind it? Because I've been hearing about this for years now, and it is very much like a where's the beef situation. You know, as far as I can tell, the Republican pro-worker agenda is like putting on a flannel shirt and standing next to a pickup truck. I would say that there is a clear set of political policies well-defined political policies that constitute a pro-worker agenda, political agenda, meaning an agenda that will increase the power of the working class in this country. And those are things like, for example, the PRO Act. The PRO Act is the labor law reform bill that is the number one priority of unions in this country. You can look at the list of co-sponsors of the PRO Act. There are zero Republican co-sponsors of the PRO Act in the Senate, I think maybe two or three in the House. That is an example of a very well-defined policy platform that is completely opposed by the Republican Party. One of the problems with the idea that there even exists a sort of pro-worker faction in the Republican Party is that the real path to reviving worker power in this country is strengthening unions. You know, that means getting more people into unions, and it means creating a situation in which unions can be stronger, have more power, and balance out capital more effectively. The idea of growing union power in that way is anathema to the Republican Party. What I see substantively speaking when I look at the sort of right-wing, allegedly pro-labor agenda, what I mostly see are two things. A, I see anti-immigration, which is typically the pro-labor conversations on the Republican side very quickly spiral into anti-immigration conversations. So rather than the conversation going toward unions and talking about how do we strengthen unions, the conversation immediately goes to anti-immigration and isolationism and things like that. And the other element that I see in practice is the culture war transposed onto business. My favorite example of this is like when the Amazon union drive was going on and they were trying to unionize the Amazon warehouse, and Marco Rubio put out a statement that was essentially saying, I'm in favor of the union drive, but it's because Jeff Bezos is woke. You know, Amazon is a woke corporation and these workers need to protect themselves against a woke corporation. Nothing to do with worker power, the need for unions to balance out capital. You know, it was 100% culture war transposed onto the business world. And that is actually the fuel of a lot of the anti-corporate sentiment that people like Josh Hawley talk about. Josh Hawley is not a pro-union guy by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the fact that we're holding up Josh Hawley as an example of like the standard bearer of pro-worker sentiment in the party, the guy has like a 11% rating from the AFL-CIO. You may have seen there was a very good piece in the Kansas City newspaper after Josh Hawley got so many shout-outs on this front by a Teamster in Missouri who wrote about all the ways that Josh Hawley has sold them out over the years, including not supporting bailing out their pensions, which Biden did, by the way, to the tune of tens of billions of dollars, being pro-right to work, not supporting a higher minimum wage, being against public sector unions, which are a huge slice of the base of unions in America. I'd be happy to go deeper into all the policy points in this discussion, but I think fundamentally, I don't know what the Republican pro-worker agenda is, and to the extent that it exists, it's not as good as the pro-worker agenda on the left.
Yeah, sir, I know you put in a kind word for unions just a few minutes ago, but it's not something I hear coming from the likes of Vance or Hawley or any of these neo-Republicans. Am I missing something?
I think you are. Let's start with Hawley and to understand why it is that Hawley garnered not just those words of praise from Sean O'Brien, the Teamsters president on the RNC floor, but also he's garnered donations from the Teamsters. Why do they do that? Well, here's a select list. Just in April, the Teamsters showered Hawley with praise because he was the only Republican to uphold an NLRB, that's the National Labor Relations Board, determination that Amazon amounts to a joint employer in the case of its delivery drivers, given the degree of control and surveillance the Bezos exerts over their workers. And that what that implies is that Amazon is under all sorts of labor obligation with respect to its drivers, which it had sought to pass off as contractors. Hawley co-authored a letter with Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, a Democrat, also reproaching Amazon for its mistreatment of its drivers. Hawley joined Teamsters striking at Gray Bar Electric in Missouri. He joined them on the picket line. And so Sean O'Brien thanked him on Fox News. He said, "I appreciate," quote, "his presence and his support. And thanks to that," quote, "settled the strike earlier this week." In March, the Teamsters lauded Hawley for proposing to slap 100% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles, a threat that the kind of the manufacturing group industry association has called a, quote, "potential extinction level event for the U.S. auto industry and U.S. auto jobs." He also wrote a letter, which got praise from the Teamsters, a letter to Treasury, basically urging them to modify a government loan to help the union preserve jobs following the bankruptcy of Yellow Corporation. So those are just a few examples, and I don't want to just focus on one guy, but it is important because it's true that Republicans have, since the Nixon era, it's not since forever, post-Nixon, have had a fraught relationship with organized labor. And I actually blame the Republican Party largely for that, because since Reagan, for the most part, labor has only gotten the back of the hand from the kind of establishment Republican Party. But it is a fact that working class people themselves are voting for the Republican Party. Last time I checked, Trump is ahead with union households in some of the battleground states. That's a reality that's happening, and it should be pause for someone who's on the labor left, like Hamilton, to so closely identify the well-being of working class people in this country with a Democratic Party that is often just as neoliberal or has been as the Republicans, and has just kind of given crumbs to the labor movement. It promised, for example, the last time around under Obama, it promised a predecessor act to what's now called the PRO Act. And that was a time when Democrats held the kind of governmental trifecta, and they declined to enact that law. And so I'm not saying love the Republican Party. I'm just saying people should be more critical of the Democratic Party and notice why it might be that working class people, or at least a segment of them, are changing their votes to the right. And because they're doing that, you know, eventually, just given the logic of electoral politics, more and more Republicans will have to give something. Otherwise, they're going to lose those voters, and they're going to either go back to the Democratic Party. You know, a lot of them are Obama to Trump voters, or they're just going to become apathetic. And that would be bad for the country, and it would be bad for the working class. Let's not forget here that anything, for example, that has to do with tariffs and immigration reform is isolationism, as Hamilton called it. Those are real issues with a kind of material component, and they are a big reason why you have a lot of Obama to Trump voters who were enraged by what the Democrats did under NAFTA. And Trump really did renegotiate NAFTA, who were enraged by the outcome of the kind of bipartisan uniparty's invitation to China to join the World Trade Organization. And of course, they don't like immigration. Immigration is not just a cultural issue. It has a material component. So,
shut up. You know, you've been friendly to anti-immigration policy, and you personally are an immigrant. How are you different from all these other immigrants?
My fundamental fact here is that I am now an American, and my concern is not for – I cannot be for the class of would-be immigrants at large. I have to care about the common good of this country, and especially when uncontrolled mass low-wage migration of the kind that's unfolding now. And it's notable, I came here legally. My family waited 7 years to get a green card. What we're seeing now are mainly vast numbers of economic migrants who are coming in as refugees, but most of them who are processed, and it's only about half who go through the processing, lots of others are released into the homeland and are never processed. Only about 20% of those or less are found to qualify for asylum, right, as actual refugees. There is a difference between modes of migration. But the fact is that mass low-wage migration, as one of my favorite reactionary writers said, a review of serious nonpartisan research reveals some uncomfortable facts about the economics of modern immigration, and immigration from Mexico in particular. What were those facts? Quote, "The net benefit to the U.S. economy from immigration, aside from large gains to immigrants themselves, are small. Realistic estimates suggest that immigration since 1980 has raised the total income of native-born Americans by no more than a fraction of 1%. While immigration may have raised overall income slightly, quote, many of the worst off native-born Americans are hurt by immigration, especially immigration from Mexico. Because Mexican immigrants have much less education than the average U.S. worker, they increase the supply of less skilled labor, driving down the wages of worst-paid Americans." Everyone knows the supply and demand factor in wages. End quote. Who was that? That's reactionary whose quote I just read is none other than the progressive economist Paul Krugman. We could get into the fact that why much of the mainstream of the labor movement and the center left was immigration restrictionist as recently as the Barbara Jordan Commission on U.S. Immigration Reform, which was chaired by Barbara Jordan, the first African-American woman from the South who was elected to Congress post-Reconstruction and a protege of Lyndon B. Johnson's. Why is it that at least then, the center left that she represented was skeptical of mass low wage migration, while it was always the Koch brothers types and my former colleagues at the Wall Street Journal editorial board who were super pro open borders. But the point is that just to be like, well, it's just immigration and trade and isolations and a bunch of cultural stuff. That doesn't have a material bearing is not a serious point. And it doesn't pass muster with lots of working class people who are voting for the Republican Party precisely over immigration and trade, what Hamilton dismisses as just culture war and isolationism.
That was the voice of Saurabh Amari, a founding editor of Compact Magazine. Now we'll hear from the labor journalist Hamilton Nolan. Hamilton, response?
As I said, anti-immigration is not a pro-worker agenda. The Republican Party has a very detailed and extreme anti-immigration platform, and even in that all of that discussion that we just heard, I still did not hear the pro-worker agenda of the Republican Party there. You know, Sean Fain actually has a good line that he often says in speeches, which is like, we don't have an immigration crisis, we have a humanitarian crisis. But look, we need to talk about what the policies are that constitute the alleged pro-worker agenda of the Republican Party. As an easy rule of thumb to anybody listening to this who is not a labor journalist or doesn't follow this that closely, if a politician doesn't support the PRO Act, they are not pro-union, period. And if they're not pro-union, they're not pro-worker. They are not in favor of increasing worker power, because strengthening unions is the key to increasing worker power in this country. I was at the National Conservatism Conference a few weeks ago in D.C. J.D. Vance was there, and the Heritage Foundation was there, and Orrin Cass was there, and they had a whole panel about the right-wing pro-worker agenda. And one guy who was speaking there was Riley Moore, who's the state treasurer of West Virginia, you know, who was talking about his pro-worker credentials as a Republican. Part of his claims of being pro-worker was, I'm against a national right-to-work law. And so I asked him if he was in favor of a right-to-work law in West Virginia, where he lives, and he said yes. Where he had the power to influence something, he was in favor of right-to-work law, which is an anti-labor, anti-union law. And then where he had no power to influence anything, he was not in favor of a national bill. And that's kind of analogous, I think, to what we hear from the right in terms of what their pro-worker agenda is. Like, if you want to talk about policy-wise what constitutes a pro-worker agenda in America, let's talk about the NLRB. The NLRB is the government agency that enforces labor law. Jennifer Abruzzo is the head of the NLRB. She's the most pro-labor, most pro-union official in the entire U.S. government right now. She's done a lot of great things. As soon as Donald Trump is elected president, if he wins the election, he's going to fire Jennifer Abruzzo, and he's going to install an anti-union attorney in that position. And they are going to systematically roll back every pro-worker advance that the NLRB has made over the past 4 years. That means independent contractors who are misclassified and can't organize. You know, that's something we're trying to reform. They're going to roll that back. The joint employer, which you touched on, I'm glad that Josh Hawley is pro-joint employer, but, you know, the whole Democratic Party is for that. So it's nice that there's one Republican who's for the joint employer rule, which would, for example, make McDonald's be responsible for how its workers are treated. But that's something that essentially the entire Republican Party wants to roll back. By the way, you can read Project 2025 has an entire section on labor. It's very terrifying, and all of this stuff is spelled out very clearly in there. I would like to not hear about vote shares and not hear about ways that workers can be convinced, you know. And by the way, the Teamsters membership is not going to vote for Trump. I mean, they've done internal polls. Their membership is majority Democrat still. But, you know, I'm not here to defend the Democratic Party. There's no doubt that the Democratic Party has sold out organized labor many, many times in the past. And it is, in fact, a problem if the Democratic Party takes unions for granted and feels like they don't have to expend political capital on them. On the other hand, Joe Biden was probably the president in my lifetime who's expended the most political capital on behalf of organized labor. So I guess I would just reiterate that I haven't really heard the policy agenda that constitutes a pro-worker, pro-union agenda within the Republican Party.
The bit about immigration, the economic impact of immigration, I spent a lot of time reading a bunch of papers on that topic some years ago, and the consensus was that there really was not very much damage to native-born American employment or wages. So it's an unusual finding coming from Krugman. I know it's an effective thing to quote from him, but that is not certainly the consensus. As the people who studied this closely.
I absolutely reject that. I can muster a lot more evidence. For example, the impact on immigration on union density.
My second point is the NLRB. That is something that's very important to anybody who is organizing unions. Ask them about that. And they will tell you that the Biden appointees, Democratic appointees, even Obama, who is in many ways very disappointing to organized labor, you're going to get a whole lot better appointees on the NLRB with a Democratic president than you would be under a Republican who has made it clear that he wants to fire the current head of it. You can talk about the individual preferences of people like Hawley and Vance, but you look at the overall drift of the party, and certainly the guy at the top, who would be the president, Trump, you're not going to get much in the way of pro-labor policy.
Okay, so let me just go back to the immigration, because
almost all you've talked about here, though, is restricting immigration and expelling the ones you've got. So,
well, here's why I bring it up is because, Hamilton's like, well, where is the pro-worker component of this? I agree that Republican National Labor Relations Board are going to be lousier than Democratic ones. That could change over the long term as the realignment between the parties goes on. They're going to have to sort of be responsive to that. But as it is, that's not such an easy issue to dismiss. Again, it's not the only issue. There is NLRB. I support the PRO Act insofar as I have influence over these kind of populist Republicans. I tell them to support the PRO Act. But we have to reckon with the fact that the Democratic agenda today is not entirely attractive. There has been a de-alignment between working class people and Democratic Party.
I just want to point out that I said up front, when you try to have this conversation with right-wing people, it goes away from unions and directly into immigration, and that's where we are now. If you keep workers desperate and poor and underpaid, of course they're going to fear immigrants because they're in a desperate and tenuous situation. The vision of the labor movement is to elevate the working class out of that situation, so it's not a matter of scaremongering against immigrants.
Sarah, you're not really doing much to disprove Hamilton's claim that when you talk to pro-worker Republicans, you're going to hear it mostly about immigration, because that's mostly what you've been talking about.
Well, no, I've also been talking about free trade. It wasn't Democrats who launched the uprising against the free trade regime that has resulted in us now imposing tariffs against China, now trying to do industrial policy and so on. That was led by the Trumpian uprising, and it was led by Trump. And now I'm glad now it's become a bipartisan consensus. And the U.S. Trade Representative under Biden, Catherine Tai, says, I have very little daylight between me and my predecessor, the Republican Robert Lighthizer. So that's a huge issue. And it's one of the reasons why you have those Obama to Trump voters from 2016. Why did they, having supported Obama twice, why did people in these post-industrial places support Trump? Was it just because of bigotry? Was it just because they're deplorables? No, because they were angry over a Democratic Party that had pushed through NAFTA. And then fast forward 20 years and they were trying to push the Trans-Pacific partnership, the TPP, which would have been another trade deal along the NAFTA lines. You guys say that's just isolationism? That's culture war? No, it's not. It's a kind of much more a reversion to a New Deal mentality about trying to think about trade. That's enduring now, and I'm glad. I think even if we have a Harris-Waltz administration, that consensus is going to be in place. But that consensus was brought about by a right populist uprising. The Democrats weren't going to go there. Their representative at that time was Hillary Clinton, who was a total neoliberal globalization type.
Speaking of tariffs, I actually was just looking at the numbers myself for a piece I'm writing for Jacobin, and Trump increased tariffs on aluminum and steel. Aluminum and steel production in the U.S. fell afterwards, and so did aluminum and steel employment. The policy was not a success on its own terms, so I'm not sure that intensifying our dedication to tariffs is going to turn around the state of the working class. These jobs are disappearing mainly because of automation and not just the evil Chinese.
I mean, automation is a component of it, and the fact that we're going to have manufacturing share of the labor force is going to be pretty hard to turn around. Maybe we can stabilize it. Being able to sustain domestic manufacturing is something that a lot of working class people care about. It's why the Teamsters get very excited when Josh Hawley proposes a 100% tariffs on Chinese-made electric vehicles. And it's also about, like, what as a nation we can do. If we just have a services-based and financial economy, that takes on a different kind of class character that is not good for middle-class people. So manufacturing revival, and you can talk about XYZ component of what you impose tariffs on and what the effects are. You have to look at it very long term, et cetera, et cetera. But just the idea that we're going to have tighter supply chains, we're going to have nearshoring or onshoring of manufacturing has become the bipartisan consensus. And it became a bipartisan consensus initially as a result of the sort of populist uprising and launched in 2016. Now, I know I'm facing, it's a two versus one debate. The moderator isn't really quite fair here. That's okay.
I'm the immoderator.
You're an immoderate moderator. But you have to reckon with the fact that people who voted twice for Obama then turned around and voted for Trump. How do you explain that? Is it, they're all just fools? They're all just, and the Democratic Party, there's nothing wrong with the Democratic Party. And now, therefore, whatever the Democratic Party says, you should accept. And you should never try to cooperate in a tactical way with Republicans. Sean O'Brien rejects that.
Every other union in America is pissed at Sean O'Brien. I can tell you that. Twitter is not the yardstick you need to use for this. Everybody's pissed at Sean O'Brien. He is a little bit of a patsy in this case, you know. I am a labor journalist. I talk to union leaders. I talk to union people in D.C. and all over the place. When unions are trying to pass legislation in Washington and they're lobbying with Congress, they would be happy to get Republican votes. Nobody is unwilling to get Republican votes for pro-worker legislation. There is a difference between that and appearing on stage at the Republican National Convention in primetime when you're lending credence to this kind of bullshit line that the Republicans are a new pro-worker party. You know, that is what people were upset with Sean O'Brien about. He was allowing himself to be waved around in the way that you have been waving him around during this entire conversation. He does not represent the labor movement on these issues. He is well out of the mainstream in his praise for Donald Trump and Josh Hawley. That is not the position of union leaders. You know, forget Twitter, man. I'm not here to represent the Democratic Party. You know, I write a lot more critical things about the Democratic Party than the Republican Party usually. The reason why we're talking about the Republicans is because I thought that this was a conversation about the Republican pro-worker agenda or whatever that might be. And after 50 minutes, I'm still not sure what it is, except what I thought, which is anti-immigration, trade, and the actual component of worker power, which is the most important part of a pro-worker agenda, I still haven't heard. And by the way, let me just say one more thing. If you want to talk about immigration and immigrants, I mean, look at a union like Unite Here. You know, this is a union that represents hospitality workers. Overwhelming numbers of immigrants in that union, and they are overwhelmingly opposed to the Republican agenda. You know, why is that? I mean, why do unions support the Democrats? And nobody's saying the Democrats are perfect, but at least in the Democratic Party, you can have the argument. The Republican Party is existentially opposed to all of these things that I named over and over again from the PRO Act on down that would actually allow union density to go up. If you think it's important to raise union density, how do you think that's going to be accomplished in a world where Republicans want to make every state they control right to work? And they want to get up and tell the UAW not to unionize the auto factories and all the states they control. Well, how is that union density going to go up? It's not going to happen under Republican control.
Okay, we're just about out of time here, so let me just bring this up. A year ago, Sohrab, you wrote in Newsweek, "For a time, I believe Donald Trump could deliver such a conservative movement, that is, a pro-worker conservative movement. But now I'm faced with the realization that he couldn't. No one could, because the Republican Party remains incorrigibly a vehicle for the wealthy." That was almost exactly a year ago. Maybe you replaced Trump with Vance to revive that hope, but a vice president doesn't count for much. Trump is 78 and looks like he's in pretty crappy shape. But are you going back to those second thoughts, or what happened here?
No. Like, premise here is that there are key pieces of union-supported legislation that Republicans need to get behind, that I advocate Republicans get behind. And more so than anyone on the right, I tell Republicans, hey, if you want to get serious about supporting workers, you also got to get serious about organizing, about unions, and supporting the PRO Act. You know, you're not going to get away with putting on your flannel shirt. That is the background music to everything I'm saying. My argument, rather, is why is it that it's worthwhile for union leaders to not be cheap dates with either side? And that's what Sean O'Brien is doing. Look at his 17-minute speech. He didn't go say, wow, I love everything about the Republican Party, or even most things. He gave Republicans a picture of what America's political economy is like from the point of view of the labor movement, the underhanded attempts to prevent workers from organizing, the systematic wage suppression, and so on. All three of us agree that those are bad things. He introduced a conservative audience to that worldview because at least a share of his members are supporting the party of the right. If you are pro-worker, you should hold both parties to tough standards and be willing to work with both.
You know, I think that one of the reasons you talk so much about immigration is that that's all you're going to get out of the Republican Party that's congenial to your agenda.
I just mentioned trade for about 15 minutes of this conversation. Trade was a huge issue. It is much harder to organize gigified service jobs than it is to organize manufacturing jobs.
The bulk of the labor force is service workers, and the tariffs are not going to do anything for them except maybe raise their costs. Hamilton, we're just about out of time, so you get the last word here.
I completely wish you luck in your quest to get Republicans to support the PRO Act. I hope you are successful. I wish you all the success in the world on that. And I invite the Republican Party to demonstrate how pro-worker they are by supporting the PRO Act and all the other items I just mentioned. So I don't think we disagree on that. Kamala Harris may be too close to big tech, and maybe we should all join DSA. But I wish you luck in moving the Republican Party to the left on this issue. Until that happens, organized labor is probably going to play in the Democratic sandbox because that's the only place the action is.
That was the labor journalist Hamilton Nolan. We've been listening to him and Saurabh Amari of Compact Magazine. A few footnotes. In the latest election cycle, out of $14 million in contributions, Josh Hawley got just $24,000 from labor. He got almost 50 times as much from finance. There have been reams of studies of the effects of immigration on native-born workers. You can find evidence among them for almost every argument you want to make, but the most common finding among them is little effect. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. As an antidote to the harsh words about immigrants we just heard, here's some of the Internationale performed by Alistair Hewlett. Till next week, bye.
Arise, you workers from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last vital FSS. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.